Michael Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
Platypus, the extraordinary story of how a curious creature baffled the world, by Anne Morrell. Now, we had the initial Australian-British encounter, then we had the French encounter, and although it's dressed up in a beautiful French view, there's sort of a certain weirdness about it, that the actual creatures eventually wound up in Napoleon's Josephine's palace, which is there. But there's also a weirdness that the information got hidden away, that the French fought so hard to get. Now we're into chapter 3. This is episode 3, called Marshalling the Animals. And this is Baron Cuvier, who's a very famous French scientist. It's sort of hard to see. He was in very much the start of evolutionary pre-Darwin debates between Lamarck and himself. And it's trying to understand gradualism and the effect of God. They still very much all believed that God was making all these creatures. Okay, this is a quote from Cuvier's book. "It is a great misfortune to science that zoological systems are necessarily not merely creatures of human invention, but to an extent also of human fancy caprice. The best zoological arrangements will never be capable of improvement. And then Comte de Buffon, a discourse on, I don't know, I can't really understand the French. "It would appear that everything that can be is." Isn't that beautiful? Isn't that beautiful put together? So the quotes are saying that, at least according to these French, that because there's a certain amount of politics and drama in the zoological order, at least it was in around the early 19th century, because there's so much politics that it's not just a straightforward scientific thing. Okay, the animal, the name of animals was the first task in the Garden of Eden. Oh. The second only to naming was the engrossing but infinitely more demanding business of arranging, classifying birds and beasts in the field and all the insects and creatures of the land and sea to form one system of order and relationship. The discovery, naming and classification of species, it became for centuries a central theme of the enterprise of natural history. Yeah, so they didn't seek to explain it, you know, why the habitats, they just discover it and understand it. I'm just looking at this gum, this orange tree, which is not looking too healthy. Got some oranges on it. We're in a temperate zone out here in Australia. I'm sitting in the sun. The key to any system of classification and to understanding the natural world was the organization of groups, subgroups, and other relevant divisions by perceptions that are recognized by their commonalities and they're marked by their divergences. So this really all started by Aristotle, who Alexander the Great kept on sending him back so many creatures. He started basically the first zoological garden in Athens. Oh, here it goes, here. Aristotle early set his mind to the question with his Historia Animalium in 334 BC, gazing upon the sweeps of creatures known in classical times, predominantly those from the Greek mainland, its islands and colonies, and some drawn from the menageries and travellers' tales. Menageries, the travelling groups of tales. I think the observant philosopher, they would say that Alexander the Great actually sent him back samples. It's also Alexander the Great had a scientific tint to it. The observant philosopher laid out a map of the animal kingdom according to the ways in which the animals were liked and to be different from each other. Faced with the Herculean task, he divided his cavalcade into two major groups, those with blood and those bloodless invertebrates. But then he went on to describe them according to their form and structure, the manner of their operation, locomotion, habits and food. where Aristotle sought in the variety of animal structures confronting him were commonalities of function, parts with which the same kinds of attributes and correlation between parts. He separated out groups of quadrupeds who shared physical characteristics of 4 feet, fur and blood, whose were terrestrial, gave birth to live young. Pushing new additions into his filing cabinets of creatures, which he gleaned from fishermen, hunters and farmers, and his own acute observation and dissertation, he turned his eye upon animals' organs. He noted the positions of the uterus, observed the placental structure, differentiated viperous quadrupeds by the perfection of the young at birth, and separated oviparous fishes, this is eggs, who lay their eggs for external hatching. From these fishes, sharks, vipers, dogfish, who were oviviparous, the kind that hatched their young from the eggs inside their body. This is amazing that he had this access to knowledge. It's pretty amazing. With the cast of 80 mammals, 180 birds, and a cluster of marine animals, 130 fishes, and an array of insects, Aristotle's treatise was an outstanding descriptive zoology of ancient times, and the first scientific classification of sentient living creatures. Throughout the Middle Ages, as well as the 17th century, his descriptive catalogue stood, adopted by collectors and the would-be naturalists, arranging their cabinets of curiosities and poring over their special collecting fads. It enabled them to impart some sense of order and relationship to the diversity of nature's forms. And yet, so it is interesting that wealthy people had collections, and in France there were people who sold, their sole job was getting samples and selling to people's collections. So these wealthy people used to tend to shoot things and collect them. So it was just a fad in Europe. As late as the mid-19th century, the comparative anatomist Richard Owen heaped praise on his classical precursor, declaring with perhaps exaggerated zeal that 2,000 years since Aristotle wrote, the ideas of learned men regarding the nature and classification of mammalia has received no improvement. There you go. So this is paralleled through every field, Aristotle field. And I don't think it's to do with Aristotle, because not much. There were other prime contenders. The late 17th century systematist John Ray, whose very Englishness secured him pride and place in the advance of natural history, adopted the same classificatory boundaries as Aristotle when it came to produce the Synopsis Quadrupedum in 1693, though he offered some alternative subdivisions. From his watchful knowledge of the organic world, Ray selected classes and orders from the classes. Interesting, this is how he developed classes and orders from the characteristics groups of animals through some significant feature, or land vertebrates like animals, birds and reptiles. He chose the method of reproduction as an important marker, but he also added questions of blood circulation. Basically, he said, this is Aristotle, it's whether it's had red or green blood. Respiration, locomotion, and birds have a different breathing system to us. To emphasize differences, thereafter, all animals were expected to be viperous, that is, giving birth to live or young, and the presence of mammalia, which females nourish their young. Signal for Ray and his success is the difference between mammals and all others. In time, though the old term lingered long into zoological writing, mammal came to replace the original quadruped. Ray stood as father of systematic natural history, a taxonomist who sought to define the system of organic nature through clear formulation of identifying taxia. His system of assigning defined categories in natural history is said to be, quote, at once the shortest and most comprehensible, and his volume found a welcome place in every naturalist library. Ray also infused his guiding format with natural theology. Everything in nature, he affirmed, proceeded from the Creator, whose eye and hand encompassed every archetype known to man yet to be revealed. His effort crested a wave since 1500. As adventurous navigators began to crisscross the ocean, the number of registered species had doubled from 150 to 300. And the pressure of identification and classification of these discoveries put increasingly demands on both the exactness and flexibility of the taxonomic systems. Into this arena of definition and classification, this international attempt to give a scholarly framework to natural science stepped the charismatic and idiosyncratic French naturalist and philosopher Georges-Louis Leclerc, Comte de Buffon, a buffoon, we say, director of the Jardin Royal Roy in Paris. So this is the King's Garden in Paris, which actually became the zoo, so the King's animals, the menageries. They had two, the King had two menageries, one for lovely petting animals and one for animals which they'd set to fight against each other. So they'd get a buffalo fighting a lion. And come watch it now, and it would be, what they'd bring heads of state to view the symbol of power. At just under 5 feet tall, Buffon nevertheless strode his world like a colossus. Natural history in all aspects, zoology, physiology, mineralogy, biogeography, anthropology, poured from his pen. When he died in 1788, at the age of 80, he had published 36 great tomes of the history naturelle. His volumes became bestsellers, and his lively and opinionated style scooped up readership and influence far greater than any other naturalist of his day. Buffon eschewed arrangement. Aware of disorder in nature, he distrusted classifiers who sought to imprison nature into artificial system. Rather, he filled his volume with detailed, superbly crafted individual description of his bestiary. So there was, in the Middle Ages, there were bestiary books of fantastic animals, sort of like children's book, but for adults. These fantastic animals, and you'd read about the various beasts, the fantastical. So it's a crossover. Each group or type encased within its chapter, which brought his procession of birds and animals vividly to life. Writings blazed with personal observations and impressions that engaged the reader and left little doubt of the author's view on any given subject. Heartbreaking of himself, he most despisedly that early zoological arrival from Europe, from South America, the sloth. He most despised, see, the sloth, the animal defects. He ticked them off conclusively, included no incisors or cane, no teeth, small and covered eyes, a thick and heavy-set jaw, flattened hair that looks like dried glass, legs too short, badly terminated, no separate movable digits, but two or three excessively long nails, slowness and stupidity, the look of his own body, and even habitual sadness result from the bizarre neglected conformation. These sloths are the lowest form of existence in the order of animals of flesh and blood. One more defect, and they could not have existed. Look at that. I love that. Le style, he asserted, est l'homme. The style makes the man. No systems of the accepted kind Buffon took. He hated sloths. Species as his touchstone, and saw them as more important than genus. Order and class. So you had the British person starting to build orders and class, and he, Buffon, just said, stuff that, I'm going to do species. Nature, he believes, quote, amazes more by her exceptions than her laws. But he also perceived a unity of plan in nature and a community of origin from one single form. Starting from the top down, from the highest orders, he got no further in his voluminous description of the animal kingdoms than the mammals and birds. The task of completing the reptiles and fishes were left after his death to his colleague, Lacépède. But his lively perception and information offered a new perception on natural history, while his language lingered in such classic maxims as "cet animal est bien machin, quand on le tique, qui se défend. The animal is very bad. When it is attacked, it defends itself. This animal is very bad. When it attacks, it defends itself. I don't understand. Yet buffoon, that greatest enemy of arrangement, as British naturalists dubbed him, was, despite his great popularity in his lifetime, to remain less influential in the long run than its arch rival and close contemporary, Carl Linnaeus. So Linnaeus system, he's got the system. Born in the same year and immersed in the same large questions, the two men were opposite ends of the classical pole. The Swedish Linnaeus, fixing his sights on genera and species, described again in Latin tongue, imposed a strict taxonomy. So it's interesting, they've got Greek words but Latin. Imposed a strict sexual order on nature and overturned the old systems while absorbing their basic aspects within his own. Linnaean system of binomial nomenclature, having two descriptive names, made it possible to assign each plant and animal its own unique place in a comprehensible system to encompass large and small categories within hierarchies. So it's thus the species of domestic dog, and which is Canis familiaris, and wolf Canis lupus, of the same genus. So the genus is the top. Canis fell within the same family of Cana itself, within the order of carnivores. Carnivores in turn belong to the mammal class, which class contained within the phylum of vertebrates. So it's the same family. It's family name and species name. It's like first and second name, back to front. I had a really bad thing when I said, well, it's like your family name. And then people said, well, no, I've got three fathers and two, you know, they really took me to town. That's a blossom high. Like Ray, Linnaeus was attracted to the importance of function, implications, and reproduction. He made the presence of mammalian milk-secreting glands and suckling relationship of the mother-young as a defining criterion for the class of warm-blooded animals, which he named mammalia. His warm-blooded quadrupeds with all four chambers of the heart and double circulations, were defined in category by Linnaeus as viparous, bringing forth the young alive, and mammiferous. In his System Naturae, first published in 1735, the descriptions of 549 animals arranged across nearly 6,000 species in its last edition. So it's first published, so it increased from factor of 10. While Linnaeus had, as one British naturalist reflected, tardily superseded the old forms, only to exalt his own name, the Linnaeus system came to dominate natural history. Banks honours the Swedish naturalist as a master. While Systema Naturalia was repeatedly published, translated and expanded, in East Anglia, an Anglican clergyman grappling with a taxonomic epic sang Linnaeus' praise in verse. I love this, it's so beautiful. This is why this book is so good. And the verse is this. And thus not only were arranged and classed the subjects of my vegetable world, but every beast and every bird, the amphibious tribes, tenants of the congregating waters of the deep, were summoned all, and all again displayed in order to receive thee their names. Beautiful thing. There were, of course, recurring discontents. Naturalists fretted over their collections and systems. Consensuses are rare. Mammals which, such as the elephant, provoked persistent debate about the placement within the scheme. Many felt free to use their own taxonomic discretion. The distinguished late 18th century naturalist John Hunter, whose private collections would be acquired by the Royal College of Surgeons, to found the Hunterian Museum. Now, this is interesting. The rich people had their own private collections. That's how you could be big in science, because you couldn't have an industry, science industry. So nowadays we have Elon Musk and Gates and stuff. They've made it big in science. People in big in science by having science industries. A group by specimens, and of course these people made their money by position. They didn't make themselves by industry. They actually provided, they were actually able to reap tax. grouped the specimens by comparative anatomy, including a good spread of mammals and marsupials according to their internal organs. Despite many legal disagreements, mammals and quadrupeds remain the most stable classification in the zoological register. Aristotle, and specifically Ray and Lanus, had marked a critical distinction between viparous and oviparous egg-laying mammals, because this is an egg-laying animal. The animals were expected to give birth to live young. Quote, "The main character which distinguishes them from other animals," said German Bolmich, underlined the point firmly in his Manual de Histoire Naturelle in 1803, "are the mammals which the female nourish the young." The exploratory expedition in the 18th century, fanning out about the Mediterranean shores and around North America and Pacific, had already dropped a great array of curious new creatures into the specimen tables of the British and European naturalists. I love that. Here's my it's a dropped in most beautiful expression. What's her name? Anne Morton. Beautiful. Yet this influx had not challenged the commonly accepted division, despite the major vertebrate classes, mammal, fish, birds and reptiles. Into the arena of categorization allotment came the kangaroo, the echidna, and the platypus. The kangaroo was readily identified as a marsupial mammal, which bore and suckled at the live young. Although the question of how the pea-like baby got from the uterus to the teats and pouch would puzzle zoologists till 1954. They didn't know that. That's really late. But the platypus. This surprised Dr. Shaw, confessing ignorance of the amphibious animal's real nature, placed it in the lowest Lian order of Bruta, next to the anteater. And its classification was adopted by naturalist William Teuton, who integrated into the Lianid system in his edition of Lianus, a general system of nature, published in 1802. In Gothenburg, Blumach, after his first meeting with the dried platypus specimen, also confided it to the family of anteaters, sloths and armadillos. He judged the Orthonohorynchus to be like other anomalous creatures, the bat, a likely transitional form between mammals and birds. But the platypus specimens preserved in spirits presented naturalists with a different scenario. So he had the dried system and scenario. The internal organs suggested that the animal resembled a lizard more closely than it did a bird or animal. It appeared to have no mammary glands, and this, on traditional systematic reckoning, flashed the signal that it did not give birth to live young and must be oviparous. Everett Home in England was also forming his own conclusions, dissecting a platypus in 1802 for a paper on its anatomy. In a paper that would furnish the foundation and description of the platypus for the next 25 years, he noted the structure of the ear and shoulder girdle combined mammalian and reptilian features, and that the internal organs using only one chamber or cloaca of the reproductive excretory function, like a bird, linked the reproductive system to that of birds and reptiles. The absence of a well-formed uterus and seemingly absence of nipples persuaded Holmes that the anitopoden duckbill was most closely analogous to the oviviparous reptiles, which produce eggs that hatch within the body of the mother. Different interpretations begged the question. Each naturalist thought the shoehorn of the little animal into their different prospective forms. Each sought to accommodate it within fixed and long-established categories, but in each perspective, the warm-bodied, furred, genetically peculiar animals from the antipodes, plainly represented some kind of transitional form, an unexpected bridge that the categories between mammals, quadrupeds, reptiles and birds. No animal, indeed, was to rub more strenuously up against the prevailing taxonomic categories than the paradoxical platypus. I love that. Paradoxical platypus. It cut across recognized boundaries, and its failure to fit the classificatory prescriptions underlines its oddity and uniqueness. Preparing his forthcoming course in natural history in 1814, Brunswick Hardwood, professor of anatomy at Cambridge University, promised to devote special attention, quote, to the astonishing union of characteristic distinctions of all classes in that extraordinary animal. Bizarre, elusive, and in short supply for examination by a comparative anatomist, the Ornithorhynchus anatus was to hold the 19th century naturalists in perplexed, persistent enthrall. The struggle to classify patriotic impulses and scientific kudos ran side to side. As the British and French expeditions proved, scientists were particularly anxious to uphold the right to classify specimens brought back to their own country. It is telling that the kangaroos, for all that scientific thing, wound up in a royal menagerie. Country's outposts and exploratory voyages. It was perhaps in the spirit of the national one-upmanship as well as an expression of the dictum that science was never at war, that Sir Joseph Banks in 1802, when the French expedition was itself pursuing the natural history of New Holland for the glory of France, reportedly dispatched a specimen of a platypus to Napoleon. And this happened all the time. So the British and Germans in World War I were just, the scientists were just exchanging letters. So somewhere after, between World War I and World War II, the scientists got pulled out. I think the scientists got increasingly into producing weapons and stuff like that. But Eddington used to write to Einstein during World War I, saying, "Hey mate, what's this with special relativity?" The symposium, Geoffrey St. Hilaire highlighted another aspect of mood of the European ownership of nomenclature and taxonomy, and he reflected on the prevailing discourse about the kangaroo. In Europe, he wrote, where our opinions are regarded a priori by what happens ceaselessly under our eyes, and where, in respect, our theories and generations have been somewhat fixed, we profited by certain vagueness which prevails. Observations and travellers have reported to us on the subject of marsupials, in order, dissimulating some facts and exaggerating other circumstances, to restore the mode of generation of these animals to a common standard. Whatever does that mean? In addition to overriding the need to provide clear and defining zoological criteria and hierarchical classes, genre and species into which new discoveries could be pressed, the ancient concept of, quote, chain of being was also fundamental to the taxonomical view. That's interesting. Aristotle first voiced the notion of scala natura that arranges organisms into a linked progression through an increasing complexity of structures from the lowest to the highest form. It's like how Buffon really hated, was it Buffon? He really hated the sloth. Just really got into the sloth. Embedded into theological thinking across centuries, however, scales of nature asserted that the immutability of species. God, it is believed, had created the entire chain when he brought the universe out of chaos. But the concept of the chain underwent change. Buffon, in his inimitable prose, embraced the idea of graduation of species. Everything was within an infinite variety that figured into a unity of plan and descended from one advanced single form, people, man at the top. The indomitable Linus, godlike himself in his self-image, did he really? Wow. I'll have to do a thing on Linus. Firmly upheld the fixity of species as one act of the divine creation, and cherished the thought that his own comprehensive botanical zoological system gave him a glimpse of the secret cabinet of God. That's amazing. But Linus also proclaimed the lineal chain of being was first to link the chain from apes to man. For Linus, man was unique in the chain, exclusively empowered with intelligence to study the works of the Creator, and its dignity exalted all above other animate creatures. The concept of the chain also found strong roots in the prevailing theological belief, teleological belief, in separate creation. Now, which is really interesting, because obviously you're perceiving a chain now, but what we're seeing now is the conversion of a train to a tree, and we're just seeing the roots of the tree at a certain point of nature. While the links, affinities, and ascension of God's creative handiwork could be perceived and acknowledged, it's widely believed that the deity, his infinite wisdom, had made his individual species step by step in distinct separate creative act. By early 19th century, acceptance of the chain of being underlay the very structure of the ecological thinking classification, yet, as large collections of new animal species from distant places assembled in cabinets and museums, the chain showed ominous signs of tangling and offering some ill-sorted confining links. Well before an uneasy Darwin scribbled in his notebook that, quote, all animals have never at any one time formed a chain. Isn't that beautiful? Other naturalists were noticing stress points and insisting that the links and affinities seen between species and families must be not be allowed to become restrictive fetters. In addition, the platypus and the echidna, the Australian marsupials in general raised questions that rattled the links of the chain. I love that. The first, when the wonderful animal that the kangaroo reached Britain, naturalists tried to place it within one of the established mammalian orders, classifying it by way of its pouch as the opossum. The opossum was the veteran of the European scene. Discovered in South America in 1500, the specimen had been brought back alive and presented to Isabella, Queen of Spain, where its strange front paws delighted observers and impressed naturalists of the natural protection it gave animals young. Several 16th century writers examining the first non-royal specimens observed that once the young were born, the mother transported them in her external belly, somewhat like a bag. Others had the good fortune to visit the New World, reported the opossum's young were delivered from the uterus and entered the mother's path after birth. She became a perambulator and their cradle. But it's not became clear to the examiners and dissectors that the opossum's reproductive system was unlike any of other animals. Several perpetuated the idea that the pouch was a place of conception, since the young found there were minuscule and poorly formed. The newborn opossum indeed weighed no more than 2.5 grains. One grain equals a very tiny amount of a gram. To thing. 20, if so tested, would fit into a teaspoon. In contrast, placental animals, the opossum's uterus was not developed for nutritional, respiratory and excretory activities that occur while the fetus develops. Room for development in the marsupial uterus is extremely restricted. When expelled from the uterus, the marsupial young are still embryonic. They are much less developed than the placental offspring and face an extended period of development attached to the mother's teat in the pouch. Such insights came slowly. Over a century and a half after the discovery of the opossum, writers still clung to the versions of the pouch, birth. In 1629, the Dutch voyager Frans Palisset wrecked his vessel on Holt's Offens off Western Australia. So I thought he did that one. So that's Palisset wrecked in 1629. Recorded in the journal the first account of Australian marsupial, the species of the Tamar wallaby, which he called cats. Their manner of generation, he wrote excitedly, exceedingly strange, the highly worth observing. Below the belly of the female carries a pouch into which you may put your hand. Inside the pouch, there are her nipples, and we have found that her young grows up in this pouch with the nipples in their mouth. It seems certain that they grow there out of the nipple of the mammae, from which they draw their food until they are grown up and able to walk. This anomaly of this kind was challenging when John Ray came to include the description of the opossum in his systematic work. He was oppressed by the conflict between the accepted knowledge of the birth process of normal viparous animals and the available information from the opossum was distinguished from all other animals by a singular and certainly admirable pouch or open uterus in which the young are received after birth. An external uterus? Discomfited, Ray insisted that the enormous reproductive process be confirmed by repeated observation in the field. It was the redoubtable buffoon, however, who, fortified by new data of the opossum's organs and evidence from the British naturalist Edward Tyson, resolved the conundrum of the opossum's birth. Tyson had secured a dead specimen of a female animal from a zoo, and finding an internal uterus, though very different from that of a placental animal, deduced that the pouch was used solely for protection of the young. With keen insight, Buffon went one step further and explained their most suitable reproduction as a two-stage gestation in which part of the fetal development occurred in the uterus and part in the pouch. True, Buffon's explanation assumed the opossum's birth was premature, an error that gave rise to much speculation. Hot air and inevitable papers on how the embryo, incapable of independent action, got from the mother's vagina to the teeth. But his two-stage model marked an anchor point of the biological theorists. The arrival in Europe of the kangaroo and other Antipian marsupials opened the debate anew. Together with the platypus and echidna, Australian marsupials presented biologists with a rich new organic forms in which existed, excited the imagination and sparked abundant questions concerning anatomical anomalies. The chain of being, the very basis of the classical system and the geographic distribution of species. Here was an unanticipated form of disturbing the systems that hitherto had served effectively to marshal the animals. I like that. Marshal, move the animals. Suddenly stimulated and brought out through the personal and national rivalries, the evidence of the Australian monotremes and marsupials will play a dramatic part in formulating a new theoretical framework of biology. 36 minutes in, and the next chapter is Wrangling Scientists. Look, I find it's great. You have to be into platypuses, but it's a great view to see how lioness and buffoon. I think we say you old buffoon, it's a derogatory term in Australia to call someone a buffoon, and a duffer or a buffer. But it's interesting that everyone believed in God, completely believed in God and all that type of stuff. And that there was no evolution, having come across everything was thought as a chain, a visual chain. That would know things of history, but buffoon was into species, and lioness was into taxonomy, and poor old Aristotle, I think, is a great explainer. And it's interesting that he was really, because people marketed themselves as explainers, they wanted to oversell Aristotle, in my overview. Thanks a lot for listening. Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.